Comrades, Fang said, summoning up his courage for one last display of his inner feelings. We still have the chance to stop this from happening, as Marshal Luo told us some days ago. We are not fully committed until shots are fired. Until then, we can say we were running a defense exercise, and the world will go along with that explanation, for the reasons my friend Zhang has just told us. But once hostilities are begun, the tiger is out of the cage. Men defend what is theirs with tenacity. You will recall that Hitler underestimated the Russians, to his ultimate sorrow. Iran underestimated the Americans just last year, causing disaster for them and the death of their leader. Are we sure that we can prevail in this adventure? He asked. Sure. We gamble with the life of our country here. We ought not to forget that. Fang, my old comrade, you are wise and thoughtful as ever, Zhang responded graciously. And I know you speak on behalf of our nation and our people. But as we must not underestimate our enemies, so we ought not to underestimate ourselves. We fought the Americans once before, and we gave them the worst military defeat in their history, did we not? Yes, we did surprise them, but in the end we lost 1 million men, including Mao's own son. And why? Because we overestimated our own abilities. Not this time, Fang, Luo assured them all. Not this time. We will do to the Russians the same thing we did to the Americans at the Yalu River. We will strike with power and surprise. Where they are weak, we will rush through. Where they are strong, we will encircle and surround. In 1950, we were a peasant army with only light weapons. Today, Luo went on, we are a fully modern army. We can do things today such as even the Americans could not dream of back then. We will prevail, the defense minister concluded with firm conviction. Comrades, do we wish to stop now? Zhang asked, to focus the debate. Do we wish to doom our country's economic and political future? For that is the issue at hand. If we stand still, we risk national death. Who among us wishes to stand still then? Predictably, no one, not even Qian, moved to pick up that gauntlet. The vote was entirely pro forma and unanimous. As always, the Politburo achieved collegiality for its own sake. The ministers returned to their various offices. Zhang buttonholed Tan Deshi for several minutes before heading back to his. An hour after that, he dropped in on his friend Fang Gan. "You are not cross with me?" Fang asked. "The voice of caution is something that does not offend me, my old friend," Zhang said, graciously taking his seat opposite the other's desk. He could afford to be gracious. He had won. "I am afraid of this move, Zhang. We did underestimate the Americans in 1950, and it cost us many men." "We have the men to spare," the senior minister without portfolio pointed out. "And it will make Luo feel valuable." "As if he needs that." Fang gestured his displeasure with that strutting martinet. "Even a dog has his uses," his visitor pointed out. "Zhang, what if the Russians are more formidable than you think?" "I've taken care of that. We will create instability in their country in 2 days, the very day our attack begins."
"How?"
"You'll recall we had that failed attempt against Grushevoy's senior advisor, that Golovko fellow." "Yes, and I counseled against that too," Fang reminded his visitor. "And there, perhaps you were right," Zhang acknowledged, to smooth his host's feathers. "But Tan has developed the capability, and what better way to destabilize Russia than to eliminate their president? This we can do, and Tan has his orders." "You assassinate a government chief in a foreign land?" Fang asked, surprised at this level of boldness. "What if you fail?" "We commit an act of war against Russia anyway. What have we to lose by this?" "Nothing. But there is much to gain," But the political implications, Fang breathed. What of them? What if they turn the tables on us? You mean attempt to attack Xu personally? The look on his face provided the real answer to the question. China would be better off without the nonentity. But even Zhang would not say that aloud, even in the privacy of this room. Tan assures me that our physical security is perfect. Perfect, Fang. There are no foreign intelligence operations of consequence in our country. I suppose every nation says such a thing. Right before the roof caves in on them. We've done well with our spying in America, for example, and for that our good comrade Tan is to be congratulated. But arrogance falls before the blow, and such blows are never anticipated. We would do well to remember that. Zhang dismissed the thought. One cannot fear everything. That is true, but to fear nothing is also imprudent. Fang paused to mend fences. Zhang, you must think me an old woman. That made the other minister smile. Old woman. No, Fang, you are a comrade of many years' standing, and one of our most thoughtful thinkers. Why do you suppose I brought you on to the Politburo? To get my votes, of course, Fang didn't answer. He had the utmost respect for his senior colleague, but he wasn't blind to his faults. For that I am grateful. For that the people ought to be grateful. You are so solicitous to their needs. Well, one must remember the peasants and workers out there. We serve them, after all. The ideological cant was just perfect for the moment. This is not an easy job we share. You need to relax a little. Get that girl Ming out there. Take her to your bed. You've done it before. It was a weakness both men shared. The tension of the moment abated, as Zhang wished it to. Chai sucks better, Fang replied, with a sly look. Then take her to your flat. Buy her some silk drawers. Get her drunk. They all like that. Not a bad idea, Fang agreed. It certainly helps me sleep. Then do it, by all means. We'll need our sleep. The next few weeks will be strenuous for us, but more so for our enemies. One thing, Zhang. As you said, we must treat the captives well. One thing the Americans do not forgive rapidly is cruelty to the helpless, as we have seen here in Beijing. Now they are old women. They do not understand the proper use of strength. Perhaps so, but if we wish to do business with them, as you say, why offend them unnecessarily? Zhang sighed and conceded the point, because he knew it to be the smart play. Very well. I will tell Luo. He checked his watch. I must be off. I'm having dinner with Xu tonight. Give him my best wishes? Of course. Zhang rose, bowed to his friend, and took his leave. Fang took a minute or so before rising and walking to the door. Ming, he called on opening it, come here. He lingered at the door as the secretary came in, allowing his eyes to linger on Chai. Their eyes met, and she winked, adding a tiny feminine smile. Yes, he needed his sleep tonight, and she would help. The Politburo meeting ran late this day, Fang said, settling into his chair and doing his dictation. It took 25 minutes, and he dismissed Ming to do her daily transcription. Then he had Chai come in, gave her an order, and dismissed her. In another hour the working day ended. Fang walked down to his official car with Chai in trail. Together they rode to his comfortable apartment, and there they got down to business. Ming met her lover at a new restaurant called the Jade Horse, where the food was better than average. "You look troubled," Nomori observed. "Busy time at the office," she explained. There is big trouble to come.
Oh, what sort of trouble?
I cannot say, she demurred. It will probably not affect your company.
And Nomori saw that he'd taken his agent to the next, actually the last, step. She no longer thought about the software on her office computer. He never brought the subject up. Better that it should happen below the visible horizon. Better that she should forget what she was doing. Your conscience doesn't worry about things you've forgotten. After dinner, they walked back to Nomori's place, and the CIA officer tried his best to relax her. He was only partially successful, but she was properly appreciative and left him at 10:45. Nomori had himself a nightcap, a double, and checked to make sure his computer had relayed her almost daily report. Next week he hoped to have software he could cross-load to hers over the net, so that she'd be transmitting the reports directly out to the Recipe Network. If bad things were happening in Beijing, NEC might call him back to Japan. And he didn't want Songbird's reports to stop going to Langley. As it happened, this one was already there, and it had generated all manner of excitement. It was enough to make Ed Foley wish he'd lent a stew to Sergei Golovko. But America didn't give away its communication secrets that readily. And so the report had been redrafted and sent by SecureFax to the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, then hand-carried to SVR headquarters by a consular officer not associated with the CIA. Of course, now they'd assume that he was a spook, which would cause the Russians to shadow him everywhere he went, and use up trained personnel of the FSS. Business was still business, even in this new world order. Golovko predictably bounced hard off his high office ceiling. John Clark got the news over his secure satellite phone.
What the hell? Rainbow Six asked, sitting still in his personal car not far from Red Square.
You heard me, Ed Foley explained.
Okay, now what?
You're tight with their special operations people, right?
Somewhat, Clark allowed.
We're training them.
Well, they might come to you for advice of some sort.
You have to know what's happening.
Can I tell Ding?
Yes, the DCI agreed.
Good.
You know this proves the Chavez premise.
What's that? Foley asked.
He likes to say that international relations is largely composed of one nation fucking another. It was enough to make Foley laugh, 5,000 miles and 8 time zones away.
Well, our Chinese friends are sure playing rough.
How good is the information?
It's holy writ, John. Take it to the bank, Ed assured his distant field officer.
We have some source in Beijing, Clark didn't observe aloud.
Okay, Ed. If they come to me, I'll let you know.
We cooperate, I presume.
Fully, the DCI assured him.
We're allies now. Didn't you see CNN?
I thought it was the Sci-Fi Channel.
You ain't the only one.
Have a good one, John.
You too, Ed. Bye.
Clark thumbed the end button and went on just to himself.
Holy jumpin' Jesus.
Then he restarted the car and headed off to his rendezvous with Domingo Chavez. Ding was at the bar that Rainbow had adopted during its stay in the Moscow area. The boys congregated in a large corner booth, where they complained about the local beer but appreciated the clear alcohol preferred by the natives.
"Hey, Mr. C," Chavez said in greeting.
"Just got a call from Ed on my portable."
"And?"
"And John Chinaman is planning to start a little war with our hosts.
And that's the good news," Clark added.
"What the fuck is the bad news?" Chavez asked, with no small incredulity in his voice.
"Their Ministry of State Security just put a contract out on Edward Petrovich," John went on.
"Are they fucking crazy?" the other CIA officer asked the booth.
"Well, starting a war in Siberia isn't exactly a rational act. Ed let us in because he thinks the locals might want our help soon. Supposedly, they know the local contact for the Chi-Coms. You have to figure a hot takedown's going to evolve from this, and we've been training their troopies. I figure we might be invited in to watch, but they probably won't want us to assist.
Agreed.
That's when General Karelin came in, with a sergeant at his side. The sergeant stood by the door with his overcoat unbuttoned and his right hand close to the opening. The senior officer spotted Clark and came directly over.
"I don't have your cell phone number."
"What do you want us for today, General?" Clark asked.
"I need for you to come with me. We have to see Chairman Golovko."
"Do you mind if Domingo comes along?"
"That is fine," Karelin replied.
"I've talked to Washington recently."
"How much do you know?" Clark asked his Russian friend.
"Much, but not all. That's why we need to see Golovko." Karelin waved them to the door, where his sergeant was doing his best Doberman imitation.
"Something happening?" Eddie Price asked.
No one was guarding his expression, and Price knew how to read faces.
"Tell you when we get back," Chavez told him.
The staff car waiting outside had a chase car with four men in it, and the sergeant-slash-bodyguard accompanying the general was one of the few enlisted men who'd been let into the cross-training that Rainbow had been running. The Russians, they knew, were coming along very well. It didn't hurt to draw people hand-selected from an already elite unit. The cars moved through Moscow traffic with less than the usual regard for traffic and safety laws, then pulled into the main gate at No. 2 Dzerzhinsky Square. The elevator was held for them, and they made the top floor in a hurry.
"Thank you for coming so quickly. I assume you've spoken with Langley," Golovko observed.
Clark held up his cell phone.
"The encryption unit is so small."
"Progress, Chairman," Clark observed. "I'm told this intelligence information is to be taken seriously."
"Polyeva has a fine source in Beijing. I've seen some of the take from him. It would appear first that a deliberate attempt was made on my life, and now another is planned for President Grushevoy. I've already notified him. His security people are fully alerted. The Chinese lead agent in Moscow has been identified and is under surveillance. When he receives his instructions, we will arrest him. But we do not know who his contacts are. We assume they are former Spetsnaz people loyal to him, criminals, of course, doing special work for the underworld we've grown up here."
That made sense, John thought.
"Some people will do anything for money, Sergei Nikolaevich. How can we help you?"
"Foley has instructed you to assist."
"Good of him. Given the nature of how the intelligence came to us, an American observer seems appropriate. For the takedown, we will use police, with cover from General Kirillin's people. As Rainbow Commander, this will be your task."
Clark nodded. It wasn't all that demanding.
"Fair enough."
"We'll keep you safe," the general assured him.
"And you expect the Chinese to launch a war on Russia?"
"Within the week," Golovko nodded.
"The oil and the gold?" Chavez asked.
"So it would seem."
"Well, that's life in the big city," Ding observed.
"We will make them regret this barbaric act," Karelin told everyone present.
"That remains to be seen," Golovko cautioned.
He knew what Bondarenko was saying to Stavka.
"And with you guys in NATO, we are coming to help out?" Clark asked.
"Your President Ryan is a true comrade," the Russian agreed.
"That means Rainbow too, then," John thought aloud. "We're all NATO troopers."
"Ain't never fought in a real war before," Chavez thought aloud. But now he was a simulated major, and he might just get drafted into this one. His life insurance, he remembered, was fully paid up.
"It's not exactly fun, Domingo," Clark assured him.
"And I'm getting a little old for this shit." The Chinese embassy was under continuous and expert surveillance by a large team of officers from the Russian Federal Security Service. Almost all of them were formerly of the KGB's Second Chief Directorate. Reconstituted under a new agency's aegis, they performed the same function as the FBI's intelligence division, and they gave away little to their American counterparts. No fewer than 20 of them were assigned to this task. They comprised all physical types, male and female, prosperous and impoverished-looking, middle-aged and old. But no really young ones, because this case was too important for inexperienced officers. The vehicles assigned to the task included everything from dump trucks to motorbikes, and every mobile group had at least one radio, of types so advanced that the Russian army didn't have them yet. Kong Dixi emerged from the PRC embassy at 7:40. He walked to the nearest metro station and took the escalator down. This was entirely routine. At the same time, another minor consular officer left and headed in a different direction. But the FSS officers didn't know to watch him. He walked 3 blocks to the second lamppost on a busy street, and, passing it, he pulled a strip of white paper tape from his coat pocket and stuck it vertically on the metal post. Then he walked on to a restaurant and had dinner alone, having fulfilled a mission whose purpose he didn't know. He was the flagman for the MSS in the embassy, but was not a trained intelligence officer. Third Secretary Kong rode the train for the proper number of stops and got off, with 4 FSS officers in trail, another one waiting in the station, and 2 more at the top of the long escalator to the surface. Along the way, he purchased a newspaper from one of the kiosks on the street. Twice he stopped, once to light a cigarette, and the other time to look around as if lost and trying to get his bearings. Both efforts, of course, were to spot a tail. But the FSS people were too numerous, some too near, and the close ones studiously, but not too studiously, looking elsewhere. The truth of the matter, as known to the FBI and the British Security Service as well, is that once a contact is identified, he is as naked and helpless as a newborn in the jungle, as long as those shadowing him are not total fools. These KGB-trained professionals were anything but fools. The only thing they didn't know was the identity of the flagman, but that, as usual, was something you might never get. The problem there was that you never knew how quickly to get the dead drop that was about to be made. The other problem for the control agent, Kong Dixi, was that once the location of the dead drop was identified, it was as easily watched as the single cloud in an otherwise clear sky. The size of the surveillance troop was just to make sure there wasn't another drop. And there wasn't. Kong sat down on the expected bench. Here he violated fieldcraft by acting as though he could read a newspaper in the diminishing light. But as there was a street lamp close by, it wouldn't tip off the casual onlooker. "There," one of the FSS men observed. Kong's right hand made the emplacement. 3 minutes later, he folded his paper and strolled off, in the same direction he'd been heading. The FSS detail let him go a long way before they moved in. Again it was done from a van, and again the locksmith was inside and waiting with the custom-made key. Also in the van was a high-end American laptop computer with the one-time cipher pad pre-programmed in, an exact copy of Suvorov/Konyev's desktop machine in his upscale flat on the Ring Road. And so the senior FSS officer on the case thought, their quarry was like a tiger prowling through the jungle with 10 unknown rifles aimed at it, powerful and dangerous perhaps, but utterly doomed. The transfer case was delivered. The locksmith popped it open. The contents were unfolded and photocopied, then replaced, and the case was resealed and returned to its spot on the metal plate under the bench. Already a typist was keying in the random letters of the message, and inside of 4 minutes the clear text came up.
"Jobbt vor your mutt," the senior officer observed. "They want him to kill President Grushevoy."
"What is that?" a junior officer asked. The case leader just handed over the laptop computer and let him read the screen.
"This is an act of war," the major breathed.
The colonel nodded.
"It is that, Gregory."
And the van pulled away. He had to report this and do it immediately. Lieutenant Provolov was home when the call came. He grumbled the usual amount as he redressed and headed to FSS headquarters. He hadn't grown to love the Federal Security Service, but he had come to respect it. With such resources, he thought, he could end crime in Moscow entirely. But they didn't share resources, and they retained the above-the-law arrogance their antecedent agency had once displayed. Perhaps it was necessary. The things they investigated were no less serious than murder, except in scale. Traitors killed not individuals, but entire regions. Treason was a crime that had been taken seriously in his country for centuries, and one that his nation's long-standing institutional paranoia had always feared as much as it had hated. They were burning more than the usual amount of midnight oil here, Provolov saw. Yefremov was standing in his office, reading a piece of paper with the sort of blank look on his face that frequently denoted something monstrous.
"Good evening, Pavel Georgievich."
"Lieutenant Provolov. Here." Yefremov handed over the paper.
"Our subject grows ambitious? Or at least his controllers do."
The militia lieutenant took the page and read it quickly, then returned to the top to give it a slower redigestion.
"When did this happen?"
"Less than an hour ago."
"What observations do you make?"
"We should arrest him at once," the cop said predictably.
"I thought you'd say that.
But instead we will wait and see whom he contacts. Then we will snatch him up. But first I want to see the people he notifies."
"What if he does it from a cell phone or a payphone?"
"Then we will have the telephone company identify them for us. But I want to see if he has a contact within an important government office. Suvorov had many colleagues where he was in KGB. I want to know which of them have turned mercenary, so that we can root all of them out." The attack on Sergei Nikolaevich displayed a frightening capability. "I want to put an end to it, to scoop that all up, and send them all to a labor camp of strict regime."
The Russian penal system had three levels of camps. Those of mild regime were unpleasant. The medium ones were places to avoid. But those of strict regime were hell on earth. They were particularly useful for getting the recalcitrant to speak of things they preferred to keep quiet about in ordinary circumstances. Yefremov had the ability to control which scale of punishment a man earned. Suvorov already merited death in Russia, usually delivered by a bullet. But there were worse things than death.
"The president's security detail has been warned?"
The FSS officer nodded.
"Yes, though that was a tender one. How can we be sure that one of them is not compromised?
That nearly happened to the American president last year, you may have heard, and it is a possibility we have to consider. They are all being watched."
But Suvorov had few contacts with the Eighth Directorate when he was KGB, and none of the people he knew ever switched over to there.
"You are sure of that?"
"We finished the cross-check 3 days ago. We've been busy checking records. We even have a list of people Suvorov might call. 16 of them, in fact. All of their phones have been tapped, and all are being watched."
But even the FSS didn't have the manpower to put full surveillance details on those potential suspects. This had become the biggest case in the history of the FSS, and few of the KGB's investigations had used up this much manpower, even back to Oleg Penkovsky.
"What about the names Amalric and Zimyanin?"
"Zimyanin came up in our check, but not the other. Suvorov didn't know him, but Zimyanin did. They were comrades in Afghanistan, and presumably recruited the other himself. Of the 16 others, 7 are prime suspects, all Spetsnaz, 3 officers and 4 non-coms, all of them people who've put their talent and training on the open market.
Two are in St. Petersburg, and might have been implicated in the elimination of Amalric and Zimyanin. It would appear that their comradeship was lacking, Yefremov observed dryly. So, Provorov, do you have anything to add? No, it would seem that you have covered all likely investigative avenues. Thank you. Since it remains a murder case, you will accompany us when we make the arrest. The American who assisted us? He may come along, Yefremov said generously. We'll show him how we do things here in Russia. Riley was back in the U.S. Embassy on the stoo, talking to Washington. Holy shit, the agent observed. That about covers it, Director Murray agreed. How good's their presidential protective detail? Pretty good. As good as the Secret Service? I don't know what their investigative support is like, but on the physical side, I'd have to say they're okay. Well, they've certainly been warned by now. Whatever they have is going to be perked up a notch or two. When will they do the takedown on this Suvorov guy? Smart move is to sit on it until he makes a move. Figure the Chinese will get the word to him soon. Like now, I suppose. And then he'll make some phone calls. That's when I'd put the arm on him and not before. Agreed, Murray observed. We want to be kept informed on all this. So stroke your cop friend, will you? Yes, sir. Riley paused. This war scare is for real? It looks that way, Murray confirmed. We're ramping up to help them out, but I'm not sure how it's going to play out. The president's hoping that the NATO gig will scare them off, but we're not sure of that either. The agency's running in circles trying to figure the PRC out. Aside from that, I don't know much. That surprised Riley. He'd thought Murray was tight with the president, but supposed now that this information was too compartmentalized. I'll take that, Colonel Aliyev said to the communications officer. It's for the immediate attention of... He needs sleep. To get to him, you must go through me, the operations officer announced, reading through the dispatches. This one can wait. This one I can take care of. Anything else? This one's from the president. President Grushevoy needs a lucid general more than he needs an answer to this, Pasha. Aliyev could use some sleep, too, but there was a sofa in the room, and its cushions were calling out to him. What's Tolkunov doing? Updating his estimate. Is he getting better in any way? Comms asked. What do you think? Ops replied. Shit. That's about right, comrade. Know where we can purchase chopsticks for us to eat with? Not while I have my service pistol, the colonel replied. At nearly 2 meters in height, he was much too tall to be a tanker or an infantryman. Make sure he sees these when he wakes. I'll fix it with Stavka. Good. I'm going to get a few hours, but wake me, not him, Aliyev told his brother officer. Da. They were small men in the main. They started arriving at Nevers, a small railroad town just east of Skovorodino, on day coaches tacked onto the regular rail service on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Getting off, they found officers in uniform directing them to buses. These headed down a road paralleling the railroad right-of-way, southeast toward a tunnel drilled ages before in the hills over the diminutive Urkhan River. Beside the tunnel was an opening which appeared to the casual viewer to be a siding for service equipment for the railroad. And so it was. But this service tunnel went far into the hillside, and branching off it were many more, all constructed in the 1930s by political prisoners, part of Joseph Stalin's Gulag labor empire. In these man-made caverns were 300 T-55 tanks, built in the mid-1960s and never used, but rather stored here to defend against an invasion from China, along with a further 200 BTR-60 wheeled infantry carriers, plus all the other rolling stock for a Soviet pattern tank division. The post was garrisoned by a force of 400 conscripts, who, like generations before them, served their time servicing the tanks and carriers, mainly moving from one to another, turning over the diesel engines and cleaning the metal surfaces, which was necessary because of water seepage through the stone roof. The Nevers Depot, it was called on classified maps, one of several such places close to the main rail line that went from Moscow to Vladivostok. Cunningly hidden, partially in plain sight, it was one of the aces that General Colonel Bondarenko had hidden up his sleeve. As were the men. They were mostly in their 30s, confused, and more than a little angry at having been called away from their homes. However, like good Russians, or indeed good citizens in any land, they got their notices, figured that their country had a need, and it was their country, and so about 3/4 of them went as summoned. Some saw familiar faces from their time in the conscript army of the Soviet Union. These men were mainly from that time, and greeted old friends, or ignored those less happily remembered. Each was given a pre-printed card telling him where to go, and so the tank crews and infantry squads formed up, the latter finding their uniforms and light weapons, plus ammunition, waiting in the assigned motor carrier. The tank crewmen were all small men, about 167 centimeters in height, about 5 feet 6 inches to an American, because the interiors of the old Russian tanks did not permit tall men to fit inside. The tankers, returning to the steeds of their youth, knew the good and bad points of the T-55s. The engines were made of roughly machined parts, and would grind off a full kilogram of metal shavings into the oil sumps during the first few hours of running. But they all figured that would have been taken care of by the routine turning over of the engines in the depot. The tanks were, in fact, in surprisingly good shape, better than the ones they'd used on active duty. This seemed both strange and unsurprising to the returning soldiers, because the Red Army had made little logical sense when they'd been in it, but that, for a Soviet citizen of the 1970s and 80s, was not unexpected either. Most remembered their service with some fondness, and for the usual reasons, the chance to travel and see new, different things, and the comradeship of men their own age. A time of life in which young men seek out the new and the exciting. The poor food, miserable pay, and strenuous duty were largely forgotten, though exposure to the rolling equipment brought back some of it with the instant memory that accompanied smells and feels from the past. The tanks all had full internal fuel tanks, plus the oil drums affixed to the rear that had made all of the men cringe when thinking about a battlefield. One live round could turn every tank into a pillar of fire. And so that was the fuel you burned off first, just so you could pull the handle to dump the damn things off when the first bullet flew. Most agreeably of all, those who pressed the start buttons felt and heard the familiar rumble after only a few seconds of cranking. The benign environment of this cavern had been kind to these old but essentially unused tanks. They might have been brand new, fresh from the assembly lines of the massive factory at Nizhny Tagil, for decades the armory of the Red Army. The one thing that had changed, they all saw, was that the Red Star was gone from the glacis plate, replaced with an all-too-visible representation of their new white-blue-red flag, which, they all thought, was far too good an aiming point. Finally, they were all called away from their vehicles by the young reserve officers, who, they saw, looked a little worried. Then the speeches began, and the reservists found out why. "Damn, isn't she a lovely one," the FSS officer said, getting into the car. They'd followed their subject to yet another expensive restaurant, where he'd dined alone, then walked into the bar, and within 5 minutes fixed upon a woman who'd also arrived alone, pretty in her black, red-striped dress, that looked to have been copied from some Italian designer. Suvorov/Konyev was driving back toward his flat, with a total of 6 cars in trail, 3 of them with light change switches on their dashboards to alter their visual appearance at night. The cop riding in the number 2 car thought that was an especially clever feature. He was taking his time, not raising his car to show his courage, but instead dazzling the girl with his man-of-the-world demeanor, the investigators thought. The car slowed as it passed one corner, a street with old iron lampposts, then changed direction, if not abruptly, then unexpectedly.
"Shit, he's going to the park," the senior FSS guy said, picking up his radio microphone to say this over the air. "He must have spotted a flag somewhere."
And so he did. But first he dropped off what appeared to be a very disappointed woman, holding some cash in her hand to ease the pain. One of the FSS cars paused to pick her up for questioning, while the others continued their distant pursuit. And 5 minutes later it happened. Suvorov/Konyev parked his car on one side of the park and walked across the darkened grass to the other, looking about as he did so, not noticing the fact that 5 cars were circling.
"That's it." He picked it up.
He'd done it skillfully, but that didn't matter if you knew what to look for. Then he walked back to his car. 2 of the cars headed directly over to his flat, and the 3-in trail just kept going when he pulled in.
"He said he felt suddenly ill. I gave him my card," she told the interrogators. "He gave me 50 euros for my trouble."
Which was fair payment, she thought, for wasting 30 minutes of her valuable time. "Anything else? Did he look ill?"
"He said that the food suddenly disagreed with him. I wondered if he'd gotten cold feet, as some men do, but not this one. He is a man of some sophistication. You can always tell."
"Very well. Thank you, Yelena. If he calls you, please let us know."
"Certainly."
It had been a totally painless interview, which came as rather a surprise for her, and for that reason she'd cooperated fully, wondering what the hell she'd stumbled into. A criminal of some sort? Drug trafficker, perhaps. If he called her, she'd call these people and to hell with him. Life for a woman of her trade was difficult enough. "He's on the computer," an electronic specialist said at FSS headquarters. He read the keystrokes off the keyboard bug they'd planted, and they not only showed up on his screen, but also ran live on a duplicate of the subject desktop system. "There. There's the clear text. He's got the message." There was a minute or so of thoughtful pause, and then he began typing again. He logged onto his email service and started typing up messages. They all said some variant of, "Contact me as soon as you can." And that told them what he was up to. A total of 4 letters had gone out, though one suggested forwarding to 1 or more others. Then he logged off and shut his computer down.
"Now let's see if we can identify his correspondence, shall we?" the senior investigator told his staff.
That took all of 20 minutes. What had been routine drudgery was now as exciting as watching the World Cup football final. The Myasishchev M5 reconnaissance aircraft lifted off from Taza just before dawn. An odd-looking design with its twin booms, it was a 40 years too late Russian version of the venerable Lockheed U-2, able to cruise at 70,000 feet at a sedate 500 or so knots, and take photographs in large numbers with high resolution. The pilot was an experienced Russian Air Force major with orders not to stray within 10 kilometers of the Chinese border. This was to avoid provoking his country's potential enemies, and that order was not as easy to execute as it had been to write down in Moscow, because the borders between countries are rarely straight lines.